The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Well, good morning. The signal on my iPhone tells me that it's about time to get underway. So if there's ever been an authoritative source for chronology, it's that. Let's begin with prayer. Heavenly Father, you are good and holy and righteous and just. The nations rise and fall to you as to a drop in the bucket. We thank you for your work in the affairs of men. We pray that you would work in us to help us better understand and reflect upon your mighty works in the past, and to instruct the children that you've charged to us to do the same. We commit our time to you now in Jesus' name. Amen. If you're following along in the notebook, the notes are on page 106. I am Christopher Schlecht, Chris Schlecht. I teach history at New St. Andrews College. My kids go to Logos School. We just heard from Matt Whitling, our principal. I've known Matt for years, and it's fun to have my son being coached by Mr. Whitling. I get to coach his kids. I do a lot of work with Logos School in teacher training, and I used to teach there on a full-time basis. I've been involved with classical Christian education for coming on 25 years now. Anyway, what I'm going to offer to you are some things that I've been thinking about with regard to history. I do most of my time with history, and many of you could be working in literature and philosophy, the Western tradition, however it's constructed in your curriculum. I'm not necessarily thinking of history in the narrowly considered sort of sense, but I've been working with the Logos School faculty to try to rethink some of the aspects of our history curriculum, and this is the product of it. So let's just dive right in. I want to begin with a question about the 1960s. Was the 60s a decade of intergenerational strife? I have to say, I've changed this PowerPoint about 12 times going back and forth between was and were. Were the 60s? Was the 60s? That's not the question. I'm just telling you about the inner demons in my mind that I'm asking. Were the 60s? It probably depends on whether or not you're English or American. Yeah, it is a decade. That's what I thought. I thought it's singular, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I thought. But then if you're British, you know, they use bank as plural or teams are plural. And anyway, but I've already distracted you from the question. The question is, was this decade a decade of intergenerational strife? Of course it was. Look at war protesters, stop the war. Now, you'll answer the question depending on what you deem relevant to the question, right? I want to offer some considerations about history in this era that we might call the 60s. Decade of intergenerational strife. Well, in the 1960s, Little League baseball grew and flourished and reached attainments of participation and involvement across the United States to unprecedented levels. The Little League organization began in the 1930s in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. And in Little League baseball, you have an arena where old and young laud the same heroes, praise the same behaviors, cherish the same values, and look at the values. By the time of the 1960s, the Little League had adopted this pledge. You would hear this pledge in addition to the national anthem recited before every game. I trust God, I love my country, and will respect its laws. I'll play fair and strive to win, but win or lose, I will always do my best. That's still today the Little League pledge, the National Little League organization. Look at the participation statistics as it shoots up from the late 50s by the time it gets to the mid 70s. The 60s was burgeoning with participation in Little League baseball. So we have over 50,000 individual participants across the United States on baseball diamonds weekly. 1960s, was this a decade of intergenerational strife? Well, actually, I've done some work as a park ranger. I'm always nerding out about the National Park Service. And the Park Service, one of the things we do is we take a lot of visitation statistics and look as we move from, well, look at the continued rise, but through that decade of the 1960s, park visitation doubled. Why is park visitation doubling in the 1960s? Who is it? Is it kids going to the park and then separately parents going to the park? No, families are going to the park. Was the 1960s a decade of intergenerational strife? Back to camping. The Coleman Company. It's an advertisement for Coleman from the 1960s. Now, the company was founded around the turn of the century. They created lanterns for illumination. But by the 1950s, they had developed plastic. We were doing some new things with plastic coming out of wartime. And you could make a cooler with plastic. 1962, they added tents and sleeping bags to their offerings. And sales for the Coleman Company skyrocketed in the 1960s because there was such demand for families to travel together and recreate out of doors at camps and camping and that sort of thing. And not just camping, but boating. In the 1950s, boat manufacturers began making smaller and more affordable boats rather than yachts. We see this change in the history of the Chris-Craft Company. Chris-Craft is an old company that goes back much decades earlier, made these wonderful wooden boats, yachts, and fancy speedboats, but they shifted their target audience in the 1960s because there was such a market for much cheaper, more affordable boats coming out of World War II, again, fiberglass technology. The Bayliner Company is founded in 1957, the most successful boating manufacturer today, and through the 1960s, they are making money hand over fist because there is such a demand for recreational family boating. The decade of the 1960s a decade of intergenerational strife? Intergenerational strife. I have shown you, I think, ample evidence that the 1960s was a high water mark for the harmony of the generations. What about Berkeley? What about the Democratic Convention in 1968? Now, my point here is not really about the 1960s, as tempted as I am to keep on going. Although the evidence for the harmony of the generations in the 1960s really isn't hard to find if you just know where to look. I've shown you park visitation statistics, Little League participation statistics, business evidence, cultural evidence. My point is this, that studying the past demands a little creativity. Drawing lessons from the past demands the imagination to see old things in a new way, to come up with new questions about the past that maybe haven't been asked before. Of course, doing history, while it is a creative work, it's a disciplined creativity that remains tethered to evidence. In pursuing historical creativity, of course, we want to give students the eyes to see what is there rather than to make up what is not there. There's a difference between creativity and making up stuff out of whole cloth. But we do need some creativity in history. I want you to think about the difference between a great teacher and a mediocre teacher. Don't you want your students to turn out better than you? Don't you hope that they're going to be more intelligent, better informed, more discerning than you, quicker than you to identify shoddy thinking, more persuasive than you to call it out, and more insightful and winsome to offer up something sound in its place? Mediocre teachers train up their students to approach the teacher's own level, to attain what the teacher has attained, or at least to get as close to the teacher as possible. But great teachers will teach students to surpass them. Great teachers will produce students. The fruit of a great teacher is a student who outdoes the teacher. And that's what we want. That's what we want. But this is one of the great paradoxes of education. A teacher's level of mastery, whatever it may be, amounts to a limitation, doesn't it? Whatever that level might be. But that same teacher, limited as he is in his capacities, is the very instrument that equips the student to surpass him, if he's a great teacher. You see, the one who is the limitation is the instrument that equips the student to surpass the limit. This is a paradox in this whole session here, is basically born of my reflection on that very paradox. Recognizing my limits, yet my desire for my students to surpass me, what do I need to do as a teacher? And I'm focusing in on the area of history here, but I think that that's a big question that applies to all levels and all subjects. I'm just bringing it to bear on history. Most curricula that I have seen as I examine history curricula center on information. I've seen curriculum guides. This is one of the projects that I was involved with at Logos School, the curriculum guides. And it guides, well, you spend this number of weeks on Greece, Y number of weeks on Rome. So we're covering Augustus Caesar. Got to hit those curriculum objectives, right? Are you dealing with Augustus Caesar in a way that helps the student deal with Augustus Caesar, or are you dealing with this particular topic in a way that can be built on later so that while you're not talking about George Washington, the lesson about Augustus Caesar equips the student to analyze something that you haven't talked about? Or are you merely equipping the student to reflect on Augustus Caesar when you're covering Augustus Caesar? This brings us to the distinction between information and skill. Dorothy Sayers speaks of the lost tools of learning, where obviously my talk draws its title, our objective being lifelong learners. That's what we're after. I'm talking now about the history version of giving a student a fish and eating for a day versus teaching a student to fish and he eats for life. That old canard, think about that in terms of history. How can you make a lifelong history learner? Well, we need to give them skills rather than simply the particularities of past moments that we might be talking about and gazing at any one given time. When you orient your curriculum around information, you are telling a student what to think rather than imparting the skill of how to think. You end up covering only the specific topics that you have time to address. And I want you to think about this. You can cover only the specific topics that you have time to address, and let's face it, you cannot talk about everything. And if you just cover the information, there's a whole lot more that you're missing. But if you impart skills to students, you give them something that they can carry to topics and to details that you didn't cover. Skills help answer questions about any time period and any topic. So when you're talking about Augustus Caesar, and you should talk about Augustus Caesar, are students receiving some skills that will help them to address or deal with something that you will not assign them later? Or are you merely talking about stuff that applies only to Augustus Caesar? It's the difference between information and a skill. All right. And then returning to my initial point, if you orient your curriculum around information, the data points that you will cover, student progress remains hemmed in by the limitations of whatever the teacher happens to introduce in the classroom. Whereas if you impart skills, students can carry those skills to areas beyond the teacher's own capacity. Consequently, imparting historical reasoning helps to impart historical curiosity, and it's one of the most important attributes we want to inculcate in a student. Historical curiosity. Do your students, when they're done with you in your classes, do your students walk down the street and look at a building that maybe they've walked past 100 times before and wonder, who built that? When? Put the architectural fabric there. Where'd that come from? Did they even think to raise the question? And if they actually raise the question, then you've actually gone somewhere. That's a sign that you've inculcated within them the kind of skilled curiosity. And of course, you should be the kind of teacher that would also have supplied some tools for help for showing them how to find the answers to that. So what I want to do, and you'll see this on your outlines, is to introduce what I call a working catalog of history skills. I call it a working catalog because I'm still working on it. And there's probably more or less, there's probably different ways of arranging this. So this isn't some sort of magical thing that's descended from on high. I want to introduce it for what it is. But in order to get handled on it, I thought it was helpful just to try to delineate certain ones. And I think you're going to get the idea of what they are. I will elaborate on some of them more than others. And so if you follow along in your outline, I'm not going to give equal time to everything you see on the outline. Some of the descriptions of these things are in the outline, so I can pass over it quickly up here. But I will be working through the outline. A working catalog of history skills. And what I want you to think about is, if you're an administrator or a teacher, and if you have something akin to a curriculum guide or a syllabus, and you're thinking about what you're trying to achieve with your students, how do you articulate the objectives, the goal? Students will know the dates of the Peloponnesian War, 432 to 404 BC, of course, right? Students will know the dates of the Peloponnesian, well, where have you gotten them there? What about things that might, as you cover the Peloponnesian War, skills that apply to all history? Does your curriculum guide talk simply about the timeline and the stuff on the timeline? Most curriculum guides I've seen, that's exactly what they do, and they don't think about the tools of learning history. And so this, in my mind, amounts to almost like a Copernican revolution. Put something different in the center rather than the info. Skills and habits of thought. And that's what I've tried to articulate here, skills and habits of thought. And again, I think some of them, I think the helpfulness to you is simply in saying it. I think that in saying it, they don't need much explanation. Information retrieval, then, is the one that I'll begin with. This includes things like research skills, finding material in libraries, going online or other repositories, distinguishing between when to and when not to use Wikipedia. Wikipedia is great. I use it all the time. What was the date of that again? You know, it's helpful. But what are its limits? That's an information retrieval skill, to be able to discern what information sources are suitable for what questions you have. I'm preparing my lecture notes. I actually Wikipedia'd a couple of things that I'm going to include in here. What? He's a college professor. He has a PhD in history. Did he just admit to using Wikipedia? Of course I do it all the time. I forget dates. And I just wanted to drop a couple of dates in my notes, and that's good enough for ACCS. Because what am I going to do, original research? I think you know what I mean. But there are certain questions and issues for which that would be unsuitable. Do students know this? Do you have this some sort of blanket wooden requirement that's not reflective? Oh, don't use this source, do use that source. Is that ever discussed? Do they have a skill to discern? So information retrieval might be thicker than what you might initially imagine. It also includes all, and this is so important, the skill of interrogating a source and aligning a claim about the past to the source about the past, closely related to what I just said. So here's a historical source. Pennsylvania Gazette from 1742. Just imported from London and sold by B. Franklin. Pennsylvania Gazette, this is Philadelphia. Ben Franklin's print shop. This is an advertisement from 1742. All sorts of fine paper, parchment, ink powder, sealing wax, wafers, fountain pens, pencils, brass ink horns, ink bottles neatly set in brass, sand and glasses with brass heads, and on and on and on. Fine pewter stands, proper for offices and counting houses. Fine mezzotinto and engraved pictures of Mr. Whitfield. Mr. Whitfield. The evangelist George Whitfield. There it is. It's a historical source, isn't it? Well, how would we interrogate this source? Do students know to think of a question that this source can answer? There's certain questions that this source can't answer. How do we interrogate a source like this? George Whitfield is associated with or contextualized within an advertisement for consumer products, which tells us something about mass evangelism in 1742. One of the first celebrities in the Western world. What questions can you answer about this? Now, if you're going to talk about the Great Awakening, do you ever derive your conclusions from sources that you present to your students? Do you model it yourself, or do you just simply go through your outline of the Great Awakening, read some sort, or do they implicate the skill of connecting a historical conclusion with a source? Whether it's being modeled or thrown into their lap to work over themselves, and I think you need to have a mixture of both. But just think about the skill, though. Think about the skill. And I submit to you that the skill is probably more important than whatever conclusion they actually come to about George Whitfield, which is the mistake I think most mediocre teachers make. Great teachers will think about that skill, and students, of course, will mature in the skill over time. Agree or disagree? The consequence of World War II for women is this. Because the war effort pushed so many American women into the workforce, women came to be viewed as no different than men. World War II changed gendered norms. That's the sophisticated way of saying, Rosie the Riveter, and look at the women here. This is a historical source. Women in the Pacific Northwest and the Boeing plant in Seattle. I'm from the Pacific Northwest, and I always gravitate to sources from. And we've got this nice Rolls-Royce Merlin engine here, imported from England. Anyway, being dropped into some sort of fighter plane. A Mustang. Okay, very good. So here she is. Does she look like a guy? How do you interrogate this photograph? Do you ever ask students to interrogate the photograph? Does she look like a guy? Are you confused about the gendered identity of this individual. Look at her hair. Look at her lips. Women are joining the armed services. Look like a guy? Why is it that the United States Armed Services actually hired fashion designers to craft uniforms for women to make sure that no one would confuse them with men because they were needed in the armed services desperately? The recruiting posters are trying to draw women in to say, come, be like a guy. Is that what this is saying? Absolutely not. Making the same point here, obviously. Cadet nurse, yes. Come join the armed services and you'll do a man's work. Cutex. A shade of nail polish. A shade of nail polish that was designed to go with uniforms that women would wear. And when you put on your evening gown after your day of work for the service, the shade still works. Elizabeth Arden, this is an advertisement that I found, and because I'm a nerd, I go through these magazines and find these things. Elizabeth Arden's newest lipstick color, Montezuma Red, inspired the brave true red of the hat, cord, scarf, and chevrons of the women in the Marines. A vivid red to wear with black, white, gray, beige, navy, and tweeds, a tribute to some of the bravest men and women in the world. Montezuma Red, designed to go with the epaulets and the insignia on a woman's uniform. Because it was so androgynous, right? Do we interrogate sources? Do we ask, what's going on here? Or do we just simply woodenly say, oh, women on the factory floors, androgyny and gender confusion in World War II? Interrogate some sources a little bit. Tease this out a little bit. I put this on an exam. Had students explain this on an exam. Students hadn't seen this before. Students hadn't seen this before. This is an advertisement that I pulled out of New Yorker magazine from March of 1943. In the ad text, you probably can't see the text, but it reads as follows. When I put this on the exam, of course, I wrote out the text because I couldn't get it to reproduce well. You two, like thousands of other women, can do men's work without sacrificing one bit of feminine loveliness. The secret is to ensure a lovely line. The better fitted to a form fit tailored to precision foundation girdle or bra, the better stores have them. You see, if you're going to be out there as Rosie the Riveter on the factory floor, you need to have the right kind of undergarments to make sure that you retain your feminine form when you're out there on the factory floor. Now, one of the things I want to point out to you is that I have actually required students, I confront students with this on a test, and they haven't seen this before. It's because I'm not testing information. I'm testing skill. I'm testing skill. Another example of something that I would give to students. This is an assignment, not a test, but just as an example. It's an essay question. Examine the following. These are PowerPoint friendly. I've got other examples too, but they're cumbersome in a presentation, but I can put this one up on a PowerPoint. Examine the following three historical sources and then prepare a well-crafted essay that captures something true and meaningful about the time period represented by these sources. You can tell. Now, I think that they're going to have to produce some information, right? And here are the sources. From Harper's Weekly, 1869, Pacific Chivalry, the caption at the bottom, encouragement to Chinese immigration. Okay, the next source, there's three of them. John Gass, Famous American Progress. And the third source is, and I have the text written out, you can't make out this text. This is something I pulled out of an archives. This is a This is the minutes from a mission church to the Nez Perce Indians, very close to where we live. I pulled this out of an archive, but it says, on November 17, 1839, on profession of their faith in Christ and by the decision of the pastor and elder, the following persons were admitted to the First Presbyterian Church in Oregon Territory, having been examined as to the grounds of their hopes some 6 months before this. Joseph Tutakis, the principal Nez Perce chief, some 37 years old, baptism of Chief Joseph the Elder. Timothy Tomosa, a native of considerable influence, some 31 years of age, and James Connor, an American born in the state of Pennsylvania. And then it goes on to say, and I had this parcel, and I had the text written out in type. James Connor was suspended from the church for the sin of Sabbath breaking, neglect of religious duties, and fighting February 14, 1843. It has since been proved that he has been guilty of polygamy, sending a challenge to fight a duel, and vending liquor. So, first three people admitted to the church, two Ninipu headmen, and a guy from Pennsylvania named James Connor. The next entry is the excommunication of James Connor. Now, students haven't seen these sources before. What's the task? Examine the following three historical sources and then prepare a well-crafted essay that captures something true and meaningful about the time period represented by these sources, and they need to utilize all three sources in their answer. This one about Chinese immigration, this one about American progress. I love this. I mean, look at the Native Americans over here. Anyway, Columbia is marching forward, telegraph wires and so forth, and for the railroad following behind, the industrial city off to the right where the sun is rising, and a record of the mission church, all from the same time period. And students then would be forced to interrogate the sources, and try to find a connection. I would suggest to you to come up with assignments like this that foster skill rather than announcing to them what's happening in the American West. Which, of course, that's only as good as the American West. Again, you give them a historical fish, they can learn, they can eat for a day, right? We're thinking about skills here. All right. Let's move on to the next skill. That was information retrieval. Interrogating sources. Reasoning about sources. But let's move on. Empathy for historical actors. And I'm going to spend a lot of time on this one as well. And then shorter time on some of the others. Empathy is the ability to look at the world through someone else's eyes. Get inside the skin of another person and to feel the world as they feel it in order to understand what animates them to act in the way they do. Think about this. A question like, why did a huge portion of the German population follow Hitler in the 1930s and 40s? Answer. Because they were stupid and evil. Okay, now, the Nazis are evil. Okay, granted. Is that historical reasoning? In fact, I would submit to you that if you can practice empathy, if you can get into the skin of an everyday German in the late 1930s and understand their circumstances and the world that's going on around them, to understand why they might follow Hitler, I would submit to you that will far better equip a student when they grow up to discern dangers of any, if any horror like that might arise again. They would be able to sniff it out much earlier, much sooner, understand its consequences, rather than the student who learned to fulminate against the Nazis. Empathy. Of course, I don't want to praise the Nazis. But don't substitute fulminating against the Nazis for historical analysis. The skill of empathy is deeply important. Deeply important for a lot of reasons. I've got examples on the outline. This is really similar. The Emperor Decius persecuted Christians. Why? Because they hate Jesus, those Roman persecutors of Christians. That's unhelpful. I think it deserves to be pointed out, and I don't want to step away from that assessment too. Why did the Romans persecute the Christians? What was going on in the Romans' mind? What were their concerns that would so animate them to do this vicious thing? This is empathy, the skill of empathy. And it helps us to understand causation. If humans are actors in history, then we need to know what makes a human act. What goes behind a human act? This is, again, empathy. All right. So, do you ever deal with, you know, why did the Romans persecute the Christians? Were their concerns economical in nature? Political in nature? Moral in nature? Cultural in nature? Why did the Romans do that? What pressures were the Emperor Decius under? What were his concerns? What did he fear? What did he aim to achieve? These are all questions that call for empathy. Oh, it's because the Romans hate Jesus and they're stupid and evil. That's why they persecuted Christians. All right. Now, this brings us to the matter of historical agency, an important concept in historical reasoning. An historical agent is somebody who actually affects historical change, whether it's through their volition, creativity, imagination, genius, maybe their aimless bumbling or sinister plotting, or by their simple pluck and grit. The point is this. An agent's actions shape the story. And to understand the concept, I could use the image of a stage play. There are some things in a play that are props. They're important, but their purpose is simply to be acted upon. Right? Simply to be acted upon. But then there are the real characters whose action actually just drives the course of the story. Right? So you know the difference between an actor or an agent and a prop. Okay? Part of empathy is the ability to construct our narrative so that we recognize agency rather than treating certain characters like stage props in the historical play, where they exist merely to be acted upon, which is to strip them conceptually of the image of God in them. Really, that's what it boils down to. So Native Americans are the grass that American progress mowed over in westward expansion. Think about that. So they're not agents, they're just stage props in someone else's story. Okay, this is part of empathy now, I'm getting at. Empathy. This also is important for encouraging our students toward historical creativity. We might be used to speaking of John Calvin when we talk about the Reformation, but what about the actions of the publisher who printed his work? Why did Calvinism, how did that proliferate? Well, there's a lot of other actors here. When some guy writes a book and theology spreads? No. There are historical processes with people behind them. What about the merchants and churchmen who trucked his writings over land, who floated them up the Rhine and out the port at Rotterdam and across the English Channel? Printers. Where were they printers? And what were they doing, and why were they located where they were located? All right. Another example. The Parthenon. Parthenon, classical Athens, we all recognize it. Beautiful building. One of the most important things that was stored in the building was silver that came out of the mines at Larium. Athens discovered a rich vein of silver at Larium in 483 BC. This discovery was very important, quite famous, this discovery of silver. And Themistocles famously convinced the Athenian people to use the silver found here in these mines to construct triremes, warships, that eventually are going to defeat the Persians. Now, most of this silver was put to the form of currency. These are actually my personal collection. I hand these out to the kids, especially the tetradrachma on the left. You should get some collections of stuff. I've got stuff. You all should have stuff. You don't have to have the stuff like I do. Get your own stuff, which caters to your own obsessions, and you should be an obsessive person as a history teacher. You don't have to share my obsessions. But so they would mint this silver. And of course, the reason why they minted the silver is because they needed coinage for the other Greek city-states to give tribute to Athens, which wound up in the Parthenon, in the storehouse, and Athena's temple. But what about these guys back in Laurium? In the height of the 5th century B.C., right in the middle of the 5th century B.C., when the Parthenon was being constructed, when Pericles was ruling Athens, there were about 20,000 people in the mines at Laurium. Their life expectancy was roughly equivalent to somebody in a German concentration camp. And this is the story of classical Athens in its heyday. Are these people historical actors? What new perspective does this give us on the greatness that is classical Athens? Empathy for historical actors. Can you recognize a historical actor when you tripped over one? Do you even pause to ask who some of the other actors might be until you invite your students to do so? Once you do, students will start interrogating the past, saying, I wonder, and they'll ask new questions, questions that you didn't bring up, people that you didn't think of to include in the story. Empathy for historical actors. This, I want to return to this. So students who begin to recognize historical agency will notice that some people were historical losers. Things didn't turn out the way the losers might have hoped. Like the slaves at the mine of Laurium. The success of classical Athens was built on the backs of losers, wasn't it? When Louis Louis XIV revoked the Edict of Nantes, he did it over the objections of thousands of French Huguenots who were forced into exile. Things didn't go their way. Does that mean that their story doesn't matter? If we tell their story, we remind our students that things might have turned out differently. If we talk about the perspective and point of view of some of the losers, then students start to see, oh, things might have turned out differently. People opposed the 16th Amendment that allowed for a federal tax based on income. The opponents didn't get their way. So again, does that mean that the opponent's story doesn't matter? Again, if we tell the stories even of the losers, if our students begin to empathize with them and treat them as real historical agents, a human being perhaps made in the image of God, then we remind our students that things could have turned out differently. And they begin to learn that history is not some deterministic affair, one damn thing after another, where human beings are billiard balls banging around according to the laws of inevitability. From the human perspective, nothing that came about in history was inevitable. Of course, God has a superintending providence, but from the human perspective, people have will and action, volition, decision-making, creativity, and that matters. And that changes things. And if our students can imagine a world that could have been a different place than it is, the takeaway message is that they can be agents of change in the world. All too often, history teachers assign importance only to those events that they can show a causal influence to how we got here today. That's the be-all and end-all of relevance, is it influenced us. We study the Greeks and the Romans because they shaped who we are today. Why study the Puritans? Because they shaped who we are today. But this approach only selects history's winners, doesn't it? It overlooks the losers. But what if the losers stood for something that maybe might have been worth fighting for? What if maybe they might have had a point? or at least a point of view worth looking at. Maybe their outlook might have had some merit. Should we overlook the losers of history simply because things didn't go their way? The great English historian E.P. Thompson once, in 1964, wrote a magisterial work on the rise of the English working class that addressed both the winners and the losers in his narrative. Among the losers were craftsmen whose skills were rendered obsolete by the Industrial Revolution. Crafts and trades that had been developed and cultivated over centuries fell by the wayside within a generation. It was a rich and a tragic story, and there were casualties of the Industrial Revolution. But in his introduction, Thompson talks about this bigger issue of agency. He warned against the all-too-common practice of only studying history's winners. He called it reading history in the light of subsequent preoccupations. It's a great phrase. History in light of subsequent preoccupations. We study the Greeks. Why? Because we're so important that they left a legacy to us. It's in light of subsequent preoccupations. He says that kind of history, that's the kind of history in which only the successful are remembered. The blind alleys, the lost causes, and the losers themselves are forgotten. And Thompson stood against this impulse, and he put it eloquently. He said, "I'm seeking to rescue the poor stockinger, the Luddite cropper, the obsolete handloom weaver, the utopian artisan, and even the deluded follower of Johanna Southcott from the enormous condescension of posterity." To rescue them from the enormous condescension of posterity. It is the height of chronological snobbery, if you're a C.S. Lewis fan, the height of chronological snobbery to think that the only thing that's important in history is the winners that won, you know, take it in terms of legacy and influence like that. Completely overlook the losers, and what that means is that history is inevitable, and the things just turned out the way they are. It's the billiard ball physics, rather than people can change the world and imagine things differently. Empathy for historical actors is deeply and fundamentally important as a skill. When you teach your students to empathize with historical actors, they will never fall into the grip of the enormous condescension of posterity. And they can gain some wisdom from the past. All right. Moving on. Develop meaningful comparisons across historical contexts. Another historical skill. Notice, again, as I list these skills, they're independent of the time period or of the info that you might be talking about at any given moment. And that's the point. And so comparisons across historical contexts. I say meaningful comparisons because it's possible to draw bad ones. This brings me to the problem of anachronism. I think you understand innately what I'm talking about with drawing comparisons. I won't explain that. I'll explain the sin to avoid regarding it, which is anachronism. It's the historical error of making comparisons across time periods without taking into account the difference in historical context. It's anachronistic to read the word gay in Shakespeare and think that he's referring to a homosexual. That's anachronism. Etymologically, anachronos, against time. When you compare time periods, be sure you're taking the differences in time period into account. Protestants tend to do this a lot. They study the 16th century and they find their issues. I'm a Protestant, an ardent Protestant. And you look at where faithfulness and unfaithfulness is designed, is laid out according to 16th century fights. And then what we do is we say, okay, let's go interrogate this character from the 10th century. Where did he stand on the 16th century issues? You know, the fight that God didn't call him to? That one. That's anachronism. Protestants do this all the time as a billy club to beat the Middle Ages with. Where did they stand on the 16th century? That's anachronism. All right. Identify and assess different types of historical causation. Moving on to the next skill here. And what I'm moving on here, and you see this in your outline, is a list of causation, types of causes. Here's another list that I'm coming. So identify different types of causation. There's an error like anachronism with historical context in the previous one. There's an error to avoid here too, which is the error of monocausation. cause of the Civil War was the economic disparity between North and South. Now, I actually think that you're short-shrifting the cause of the Civil War if you take that out of the equation. But goodness, are you doing the cause of the Civil War justice by reducing it to that? That's a monocausal explanation. The antidote to monocausal reasoning is to teach students to appreciate and to develop skills in looking for causes, varieties of kinds of causes. So, and I've just listed six: environmental, social, intellectual, cultural, ethical, technological, and I'm not going to illustrate all of these. I want to illustrate the environmental for a moment, though, to see how this works. So, what city is this? Very good. You can recognize it by a landmark right there. What is that landmark? Gateway to what? Oh, St. Louis is the gateway to the West. And you look at the major fur trade routes in the United States. If you study the fur trade, all roads lead to St. Louis, which, of course, is on the Mississippi River, go out to Louisiana and the Gulf of Mexico and so forth. So it's the gateway to the West. Let's just look at the map. All right, what city is this? Anyone recognize it? Okay, this is Chicago, so you're at Lake Michigan here. Huh. Not fur trade routes, but we're just a generation later, and Chicago, all roads lead to Chicago, railroads lead to Chicago. Why are the fur trade roads going to St. Louis and the railroads going to Chicago? Just one generation. I thought that St. Louis was the gateway to the West. Looks like Chicago's the gateway to the West. How'd that happen? Well, there they are. St. Louis, and think about how we're going to get to the market here. Here's the big marketplace right here, New York. How do you get something from St. Louis to New York? Well, down the Mississippi, Gulf of Mexico, around, and so forth. How do you get something from Chicago to New York? Well, you don't. Until this shows up. The Erie Canal. Oh, this is really interesting. So Chicago through Lake Michigan, here on Lake Erie, and then you get to an important city here that goes to the Hudson River. Ah, the Erie Canal and that important city on Lake Erie is what? Anyone know? It's Buffalo. Okay, Erie Canal, and there's Buffalo right there. What's going on here? Buffalo. Now, I'm from wheat-growing country in Idaho, and so I love grain elevators. But the first one showed up in Buffalo. Why did the first grain elevator show up in Buffalo? Steam-powered grain elevator. It showed up in Buffalo. Now, this is a great story. I'd love to just go on and on about this. A huge development showed up, first one in 1843, and it moves us from manually hauling sacks of grain to mechanically conveying grain. Oh, it's so removed labor, harnessing steam power to put grain into these elevators. And so if you go to Chicago today, many of the grain elevators are still there today. It's the grain elevator capital of the world. Why did this happen? Well, I want you to think about a grain elevator versus sacks of grain. A grain elevator is this stationary, stable entity that needs to be on the water side, and it's going to connect to Chicago on Lake Michigan. Now, this comes from the National Weather Service. You probably can't see these numbers here. The Lake Michigan water levels on Lake Michigan at Chicago, this goes from 1902 to now, and then 2027. And this is 175 feet, 175.6, 175.8, 176 feet, 177 feet. Water level on Lake Michigan at Chicago over the last 100 years has varied about 3 inches. Lake Michigan water levels, you can see 176, 175 feet above sea level. I pulled this off the web just last night. Mississippi River water levels at St. Louis. Here's today right here. June 24th right here. Water level is 18.82 feet. But by this time next week, it's going to be down to 8 feet. Water level in the Mississippi River is going to drop 10 feet next week. Can you put a grain elevator on the Mississippi River? No. It's unsuitable for grain elevators because of the water level. Environmental causation. Is place meaningful in historical analysis? And do you train your students to think about that? Is place meaningful in historical analysis? Why do we move from St. Louis to Chicago as the gateway to the West? Well, just look at the water levels of the places where they are. It's a big deal. It's a big deal in historical analysis. Like I said, I was going to highlight or illuminate certain of these and give unequal time to them. There's historic trends in Mississippi River water levels, and you see the radical variations. All right, lesson plan then. Okay, students, you're going to divide the class into two groups. Drama, and you're going to represent the interests and transactions of the following individuals in moving a piece of grain from a farm into a New Yorker's table. And you're going to put on a play, and these are the characters: Midwest wheat farmer, a railroad hauler, a Mississippi River boat, a shipper, an ocean-going shipper, New York wholesaler, and New York baker. From a Midwest farm to a bakery shelf. And students, then, I would just, here you go, do this, figure it out, and write a play that's going to get the grain from the farmer's field to the table in New York, and they need to figure out the agency of the actors and what's happening. And then the other group is going to do it from Chicago. And the agency of the actors, a couple different characters. That's just a lesson plan. They can figure this out, and they can learn and walk a mile in the shoes of the Chicago wholesaler, the Great Lakes shipper, right? Okay, then social causation, you're probably used to that, and I elucidate that in the outline. How demographics matter, the fact that you're poor, the fact that you're white or black, the fact, you know, these are social causes. Those are meaningful in historical analysis too, but again, they're not the only things. You can avoid monocausation if you're looking at an array of factors. This is a factor. Intellectual causation, classical educators are used to this, how ideas shape things. Like the fact that you're a communist, or this ideology, this political affinity is causal and meaningful in history. Cultural causation, we might be less used to this. I've got an illustration of this, a couple of illustrations of this in the outline. But we go in the American West, say, to a mining camp, 1849. Here's a whole big population of men there. And they still needed to prepare food and wash clothes, which, according to norms, was lesser subordinate work, and it was gendered feminine. And so who did they give those jobs to? Well, they shifted from gender to race. And so the Chinese wind up as the food preparers and the clothes launderers. This, now, cultural causation has to do with the meanings that we attach to different things, life ways, that kind of, what's the meaning of labor? There I was getting at gender and race.